This was the mood in which to fight the last battle. This fine blend of sadness and anger. So Huey thought as he strode with Lannan along the ranks. The sun was up, throwing long shadows on the pale brown grass of the plain. On their left stretched the cheerful azure of the lake, flecked with crests of white by the morning breeze. The waterfowl flew low in loose V formations, white against the cloudless blue of the high heavens. On their left rose the rugged rampart of the cliffs, touched with subtle shades of rose and pink, and capped with dark green vegetation. Hui, looking at lake and cliff, saw them only as points on which to anchor his flanks. Ahead, in front of the walls, the land was open, with low scrub and very few big shady trees. It sloped gently from cliff to lake shore, a Roman mile wide. It was a clear front from which no surprise could spring, although it undulated in a series of low rises like the swell of a sleepy ocean. In their rear were the buildings and streets of the lower city, a maze of low clay walls and flat roofs, while further back rose the massive stone walls of the temple, and above them showed the tops of the sun towers. This, then, was a good place in which to fight the last battle. This attenuated front, with firm flanks and an open line of retreat. Lennon strode along the ranks. There was a spring and purpose in his step that belied his tired eyes and grief-sick face, the face of a man who had seen his family burned to death while he stood by. Hui followed a pace behind him, walking with the long-legged, crabbing gait which was so familiar to them all. The axe was on his shoulder, and the armor shaped to his bowed back was highly polished and sparkled in the sunlight. Backmore and a group of officers followed him. The legions were drawn up into their battle formations, and Hui could find no fault with the placing. The light infantry thrown out in a screen, each man armed with a bundle of javelins as well as his sidearms. Behind them were placed the heavy infantry, big men armed with axe and war spear, carrying a great weight of armor. These men were the backbone of the legions. When hard pressed, the light infantry could retire through their ranks and let the enemy spend themselves upon this solid reef of armor. In the rear were the archers, drawn up in neat blocks from which they could deliver massed flights of arrows over the heads of the infantry. Behind them again were the baggage boys, ready with the bundles of fresh javelins and arrows, bags of cold meat and corn cakes, amphorae of water and wine, spare helmets, swords and axes, and those other items which the battle would expend or destroy. At first, Lannan's procession along the ranks was in silence, the men at ease resting on their weapons, many with their helmets removed, some of them munching a last mouthful of food, all of them with that surface calm of the veteran who has walked many times with old Dame Death, who knows well her whore's face and the smell of her breath. Many of them still showed the recent marks of her claws upon their bodies. But there was no sign of fear on their faces, no shadows in their eyes. Hui felt a humbleness when he met their steady gaze, a pride when one of them grinned and called out, "We've missed your holiness." "It's good to be back," Hui told him, and there was a growl of assent from those who heard him. Hui passed on. A ripple of animation followed him now. Quick banter, in which Lannan and the officers joined. "Leave a few for us, Sunbird," a grizzled old centurion shouted. "I think there'll be enough for all of us," Hui grinned at him. "Too many?" another voice called out. "Not enough," Lannan answered, "for none of those who oppose us is named Ben Ammon." They cheered then lustily, and it was taken up all along the line from cliff to lake. New waves of sound and shouting followed them as they went to take their place at the center of the line upon a rise of higher ground where they could see over the whole field. Above their heads the standard stood, gaudy with gleaming gold and silken multicolored tassels, and at their backs the 100 men of the temple guard. Hui looked over the precisely laid out cohorts with the sun sparkling on their helmets and weapons, and thought that these were good men with which to fight the last battle. Good men in whose company to die. He loosened his helmet and lifted it from his head, holding it in the crook of his arm. "Wine here," he called, and baggage boys came scampering to them with bowls and amphorae. It was the best of Hui's own stocks, rich and red as the blood which would soon soak this field. Hui saluted his officers with a raised bowl, and then turned to Lannan. They looked at each other for a long moment. "Fly for me, bird of the sun," said Lannan softly. "Roar for me today, lion of Opet," Hui answered him, and they drank, broke the bowls, and laughed together for the last time. The men about them heard them laugh, and taking courage from it, they looked to the north. Manatasi came in the middle of the bright, hot morning. He came on a front that filled the plain from lake shore to cliff foot. He came singing with 500,000 throats, and the rhythmic slapping of bare feet and war rattles which rolled across the sky like the thunder of the heavens. He came in orderly ranks, spaced to give each man fighting space, but the rank behind pressed hard upon that ahead, ready to close any gap in the line, to show a solid, unbroken front. He came in rank upon countless rank, so there was no end to his advance, and the singing was deep and murmurous. He came like the shadow of storm clouds, moving stately and slow across the land. He came dark as night, and numerous as the grass of the fields, and the singing took on a harsher, more menacing sound. Hui settled his helmet and tightened the strap. He untied the leather sheath from the vulture axe and watched Manatasi advance on a million moving legs, like a single vast black animal, topped with a froth of feather headdresses, and the spear blades sparkled like multiple insect eyes in the blackness. He had never in all his life seen a sight to compare with Manatasi in his full power. "This is a worthy foe with whom to fight the last battle," he thought, "for there will be no dishonor in defeat by such a one." Manatasi rolled on deliberately past the markers which Hui had placed on his front to measure the range. 200 paces, 150, and the dust from a million stamping feet rose, as a bank of fire-golden smoke over the horde, blanketing them so that they seemed to appear endlessly out of the moving, shifting loom of it. Hui felt his mouth drying, and the tingle of his blood as it sped through his tensed body. He lifted the vulture axe high and glanced left and right to make certain that each commander of the archery had seen the signal. 150 paces, the black tide washed towards him, and the singing changed again, rising, shrilling into the blood trill, the high ululation as chilling as any sound Hui had ever heard. He felt the hair on his forearms and at the back of his neck come erect, and his bowels seemed to drop out of his body. They came on still, trilling, stamping, drumming with spear on shield, headdresses dipping and tossing, and Hui stood with his axe held aloft. 100 paces. And Hui brought down the axe, and instantly the air was filled with the soft fluting, the whistle of the wings of wild duck at sunset. The arrows rose, arched over and fell into them in thick, dark flights like that of the locust, and a growl came out of the blackness, the growl of the beast. But it came on steadily into the javelins, seeming to pass through them unscathed, for the gaps in the front were instantly filled and the fallen were hidden by the dense mass of bodies passing over them. Hui's light infantry melted away before this massive advance, falling back through the heavies behind them, and Manatasi rolled weightily into Hui's front. It seemed as though nothing could check it. It was too heavy, too wide, and deep and strong. It must burst through this line of bright helmets. And then, unbelievably, the blackness was no longer moving forward, but piling up on itself, like a log jam in a river. The ranks pressing forward violated the fighting space of those in the van, catching them in a struggling mass, throwing them onto the prickly metal hedge that was Hui's front line. Suddenly, it was drawing back, sucked away like the wave of the sea from a steep beach. Immediately, the javelin men advanced through the heavies to harass the retreat, while the cry of the centurions carried clearly to Hui as they repaired their line. "Close up here! Javelins here! Fill that gap! Men here! Men here!" Manatasi drew back and bunched, gathered himself like a humping wave, and surged forward again. Struck, pressed hard, gained a yard of ground and drew back again. Gathered himself, started forward, gaining momentum and crashing into Huey's front once more. At noon, Lannan and Hui were forced from their vantage point as the fighting surged about their feet. The standards moved back. An hour after noon, Hui ordered the last of his reserves into the line, holding only the temple guard under his own hand in a bunch around the battle standards. And still the black waves burst upon the line with a terrible, unvarying rhythm, like the groundswell of the ocean. Hui gave them ground slowly, drawing back each time just enough to reaffirm his line. It was stretched so finely now that it seemed that each new rush of blackness must rip through it, but still it held. Then they were into the lower city, fighting back along the streets, and Hui was cut off from visual contact with the battle as a whole. It was merely a narrow street plugged with a knot of legionaries holding back a steady rush of black warriors. For the first time that day, Hui was drawn into the fighting. A small group of wild-eyed black men burst through the rank ahead of him. They were shiny with sweat and grease, their faces painted with stripes of white ochre, making them appear monstrous and unreal. Hui cut them down quickly and ordered a squad of the temple guard into the gap they'd opened. He knew then that the battle was out of his control. He and Lannan were isolated in a cell of fighting men, able only to direct those of their men within sound of their voices. From some distant part of the field came an animal roar of triumph, and Lannan caught Hui's shoulder and shouted into his ear, "I think they've broken through!" And Hui nodded. The set battle was over now. Hui knew that. Through many gaps in his shattered line, the enemy was pouring. It would become a rout now. The miracle had not taken place. The last battle was lost. "Fall back on the temple?" Lannan shouted the question, and again Hui nodded. The army of Opit was no more. It was reduced to hundreds of isolated groups of desperate men, locked shoulder to shoulder and back to back, in their last fight. A fight from which there would be no surrender, from which death was the only surcease. They gathered the temple guard about them and moved back along the street, keeping a steady pace, closed up and in hand, offering a solid carapace of shields to the enemy. Manatasi's hordes were in their rear now, between them and the temple. They had put fire into the lower city, and the flames were taking a swift grip. The streets through which Hui marched were choked with terrified citizens and groups of wild, blood-spattered warriors. Hui drove through all of them, his shields locked in the testudo formation, immune to the press of black men in the rear and the greasy billows of black smoke which spread over them. The main temple gate was open and undefended. The guards had fled. The temple enclosure was empty and silent. Hui and 10 men held the steps, while Lannan had the gates swung closed, and at the last instant Hui raced back with his men through the closing gap. They were resting on their bloody weapons, loosening helmets, wiping the sweat out of their eyes. "The East Gate," Hui demanded of Lannan. "Is it held? Did you send men to close it?" Lannan stared at him with dismay, his silence answering Hui's question eloquently. "You men," Hui picked a group with a quick wave of his arm, "follow me." But it was too late. Across the temple enclosure, black warriors were streaming through the smaller gate. "Testudo!" shouted Hui. "Back to the cavern!" They formed the tortoise again, and moved like an armadillo, with metal scales, across the enclosure while the warriors swarmed about them, unable to pierce the shell. Smoke from the burning city eddied about them, choking them and blinding them. Suddenly, the man beside Hui cried out and grabbed at his groin. Blood spurted out between his fingers and he dropped to his knees. The ground over which they were advancing was strewn with dead warriors cut down by the head of the tortoise. They had to step over them. Dozens of these bodies who had been feigning death suddenly came to life, rolling quickly onto their backs and stabbing up under the skirts of the men above them. Hui shouted a warning, but it was in vain. The enemy were inside the body of the tortoise, leaping to their feet, thrusting and hacking about, forcing Hui's men to turn and defend themselves, exposing their backs to the warriors on the outside. The tortoise disintegrated into a mob of individuals, and the black swarm poured over them as hiving bees. "With me!" And Hui gathered Lannan, Backmore, and a few others about him, and they broke out of the mob in a tight bunch and raced for the cleft of the cavern. The smoke was thick and oily, choking them, so they coughed as they ran. Hui swung the axe, cutting a path for them, and five of them reached the entrance to the cavern, but Backmore had taken a thrust through the ribs. He pressed one fist to it, trying to staunch the flow of lifeblood. Hui changed the axe to his other hand and helped Backmore up the steps into the mouth of the cleft. His blood ran down Hui's side. It felt hot and gelatinous. On the top step, Backmore stumbled to his knees. "It is finished, Hu," he cried. But Hui picked him up bodily and carried him into the entrance. He propped him against the wall of the cavern. "Backmore," he panted, and pushed his head back to look into his face. Backmore's eyes looked back at him without seeing, dead and glazed. Hui let the handsome head drop forward and stood up. "Here they come," shouted Lannan. And Hui hefted the axe and leapt to Lannan's side to meet the first dark rush of bodies into the passage. The four of them, Lannan, Hui, and two legionaries, held the entrance long enough to clog it with piles of dead warriors. Then the archers came up, and the first volley of arrows swept the passage. One of them struck a legionary in the throat, and he fell with a dark gush of blood from his mouth. "No cover in here," Hui shouted. "Back to the temple." They raced back along the passage, and the next volley whistled amongst them. One struck Hui's helmet and glanced away to light sparks off the wall beside him. Another found the seam in the last legionary's breastplate and lodged in the bone of his spinal column. His legs collapsed under him. Desperately, he clawed his way after Hui, dragging his crippled body by the sheer strength of his arms alone. "Your favor, my lord!" he screamed in terror of the castrating blade and the ripping of his bowels while he still lived. "Don't leave me for them, holiness!" Hui checked his run and shouted, "Go on, Lannan, I'll follow you." He went back, and the legionary saw him coming. "Baal's blessing on you, holiness," he cried, and tore his helmet loose, bowing his head forward to expose the neck. "Find peace," Hui told him, and cut his head from the trunk with a single stroke of the axe, turning to run again as he did so. An arrow hit Hui in the face below the eye, glanced off the bone, and sliced him open to the ear, dangling there by the barb in the fleshy skin. Hui tore it loose as he ran after Lannan. Together they crossed the cavern of Astarte, their footsteps echoing from the domed walls, skirting the still green pool, they reached the door of the temple as the next flight of arrows hummed around them. Lannan stumbled slightly, and then they were into the temple. Can we hold them here? Lannan gasped. No, Hui stopped to catch his breath. The archives. And then he looked at Lannan. What is it, Majesty? I also am hit, Hui. The arrow stood out of the joint of his armor near the left armpit. The angle of penetration was such that Hui felt a cold gust of despair. The arrowhead must lie close to the heart. It was mortal. No man could ever recover from a wound of that nature. How is it? Lannan demanded. There is no pain, Hui. It can't be too bad. You're lucky, said Hui, and snapped off the shaft, leaving a short stub protruding from the wound. Come, he said, and with a gentle hand on Lannan's arm, led him back through the temple into the archives. The sun door? Lannan asked. Only at the very end, said Hui. Only when all else fails. And he steered Lannan into one of the stern recesses. Your face! Lannan stared at Hui in the uncertain light of the torches, as though he'd noticed the gaping slash across his cheek for the first time. No doubt it's an improvement, Hui grunted, as he tore a strip from his tunic and knotted it into a crude sling for Lannan's left arm. Can you use it? He asked, and Lannan worked his fingers opening and closing them. Good. Hui nodded and placed the tang of Lannan's shield in his left hand. The sling would help support the weight of it. Hui cocked his head, listening to the stealthy footsteps, the whispered voices, and the clink of weapons within the temple of Astarte. They're coming, he said. It won't take them long to find the passage. As he spoke, the first of them stepped through the entrance from the guardroom and peered into the archives. The wavering light of the smoky torches in their wall brackets emphasized the man's size. He was huge and black, shiny with grease and paint, and Hui smelt him, a warm, musky smell like that of a predatory cat. Hui stepped out of the recess into the light, and Invendi shouted a challenge at him. The warrior came bounding down the passage at Hui, and their shields came together with a clash that echoed through the temple. Hui felt the spear blade sting his side, but the lance on the tip of the vulture axe bit in deep, touching bone, and the warrior slid down off the steel. Lannan limped out of the recess and took his place on Hui's left hand. They stepped over the shivering, twitching corpse and went down the passage side by side to meet the rush of dark bodies that came at them.